Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, employee-owned and operated, and founded on the principle of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Welcome to Food Talk this Thursday. Nice warm spring day in New York City. Let's hope winter's over. Last week it got cold again. It's supposed to rain tomorrow. I think we're almost out of this. Went to Peking Duck House last. You know, people talk about how Manhattan's Chinatown isn't the thing anymore. There's a whole like New York crowd that's the everything's better in Flushing crowd. You know who those guys are? It's like Chinatown's better in Flushing. It's kind of true. Flushing has amazing Asian food. Probably the best Korean. Certainly the best Philippine, great Chinese, Corona's got Mexican. But Manhattan's Chinatown's the OG. It's the original one, and it's great. And one of my favorite places was there last week, Friday night, is the Peking Duck House. I was just jonesing for Peking Duck. They bring the duck to the table, slice it, serve it with these little pancakes, hoisin sauce, scallions, cucumber. And the best thing about the Peking Duck House is, if you're a wine person, you can bring your own wine, no corkage fees, which is crazy. So a lot, I know this because a lot of my Somme friends do this. So I have these pictures at the Peking Duck House, and they've got like $350 worth of wine on the table. No corkage fee. Why not? So that's why I go there. Love the Peking Duck House. Love that. Was there last week. We've got a fun show this week. We've got somebody here who's been helping to make my PBS show possible really since day one. That's Colavita Olive Oil. Giovanni Colavita is in the house with us here. He's also helped to make this show possible for the last 3 years and sustain this network. And with him, his cohort today is Jerry Tursi, who's a character. Jerry is a Neapolitan guy. He went to the finest schools in Naples and graduated at the top of his class. Then he went on to the Harvard of Italy, whatever that is, and magna cum laude, several postgraduate degrees in various things, which we will go into later. And besides all of that, besides that academic pedigree, he runs an amazing store in Englewood, New Jersey. And I don't know, I used to do radio at WOR, which was a big commercial AM broadcast call-in station, iconic New York station. It was one of the best stations in New York City for years and years until it was sold when the owner unfortunately died unexpectedly, and the family didn't want to run it anymore. But I used to have to do all kinds of stuff. I was on the radio 6 days a week. It was a live call-in show. We always had themes and trips. And at some point on my radar at WOR, I must have gotten in my car. I went to visit Jerry because his place is in Englewood, New Jersey, and it's not like in a mall. It's not like on a main street. It's like an industrial park. It's a 28,000 square foot specialty store, I think I can call it that, where they make fresh mozzarella every day, prepared foods to go every day, a great selection of Italian specialties, and the prices are crazy. Just this past weekend, the Bergen Record, which is like the paper of North Jersey, had a big two-page spread on Jerry. And here's a couple of quotes on what he's doing. Where is this price stuff I have? 250 grams of Spinosa pasta, Amazon.com. And I buy stuff from Amazon because they deliver it in 2 days because I'm an Amazon Prime junkie. On Amazon Prime, you'll pay $17.50 for that pasta. He's got it, seriously, $5?
$5.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Johnny Colavita's here. 3 liter tin of Colavita olive oil, which in my house will last 3 weeks to a month. $39.99. Usually that's the retail price. Sometimes you'll see a discounted at ShopRite once in a while. He's got it for $10 less. Excuse me, $15 less at $24.99, I guess. We'll have to talk to Giovanni how he does that. We've got to talk. We've got to get a deal here. You must be buying straight containers. We don't know. Anyway, welcome both you guys. Giovanni, let's talk with you just for a second to get started. So when I was a kid, which is the 60s and 70s, which is a horrible thing to think about, I remember like when President Kennedy got shot and that just
I was just born.
God bless you. I don't think you were born yet. But anyway, it was like the dark age of American cuisine. Like the 50s were bad. The 60s were the worst. We were women just didn't, you know, my mom's generation didn't want to spend time. My grandmother was amazing, Italian from Molise. She was every Sunday there was lights out. The food was amazing. So I kind of grew up in that bubble of like Italian neighborhood. We didn't eat fast food. My grandma was an amazing chef. But my mom didn't want to cook. Her food was terrible. We would die. We'd have to eat dinner with her. It was like the worst. And people were moving, like supermarkets took over. Like the space program had a big influence on America. I knew a lot of middle class, non-ethnic families where I'd go shopping with them and they would buy like powdered milk and Tang was a powdered orange juice because the astronauts were doing this stuff. That's what people were doing. So it was like, that's what we grew up eating, white bread. I mean, outside of like Italian neighborhoods, you just kind of grew up eating crap. And if you wanted to buy olive oil, you couldn't find it in the supermarkets. It didn't exist. So John Profaci's dad, John Profaci Sr., hooked up with your dad at some point in the 70s, maybe, late, early 80s?
Well, 78.
78. I had the time frame right. And got this idea to import Colavita olive oil, to bring it in. John's dad was in the food business, and he went to a guy named Harold Anderson, who somebody should write a book on this guy. He's a legend. Harold started out as a peddler in South Jersey, selling canned vegetables and pickled fruit off of a truck. And in the span of his lifetime, built the largest gourmet import distribution company in America. At its heyday, before they pared it down, he had 17, 18, 19,000 SKUs in his catalog. It was like a super. You could buy anything. He would bring in a case of mustard if you wanted it. So anyway, he went to Harold and said, "Harold, I've got this olive oil." And Harold said, "Let's do it." They built the business up, and as you mentioned, you know, Colavita is like the iconic extra virgin olive oil in the country now. Wasn't always like that, so. Now you're on board. Colavita's here in the States. You live here. Your brother's on the West Coast. Your sister's here too?
No, she travels back and forth.
She goes back. Let's go back. Was it 3 years that the harvest was terrible? 15?
The years was that this one and 2 years ago.
2 years ago. Talk about the harvest because olives are this funny thing. They grow all over southern Europe, starting in southern France and Provence, all over Spain, all over Portugal. Throughout Italy, Sicily, Greek, and then, of course, in the Mediterranean. They've got them in Tunisia, Morocco, all those places. That's where olive trees grow. Talk about the last couple of harvests, because it's so funny. It's almost like grapes. I look at olives and grapes the same way, because neither of them like oxygen, neither of them like heat. They're very specific in terms of terroir and varietals. How bad was this year compared to 2 years ago?
Yeah, this is... first of all, thanks for inviting me.
Pleasure, man.
To be here. This is something sometimes it's difficult to pass to the final consumer because nobody talks about unless like in producing country. Like in Italy, it's a big talk about shortage of production because this year, for example, Italy produced 50% of the last year production.
So it's down 50%?
50%. And last year was double of the previous year. So 2 years ago was the same problem, 50% production. And in this unfortunately, in this situation, two problems combined. Production and quality. So when you have a quality problem and a production problem, this year is very difficult to source the the good quality you need to pack the product. Last year has been particularly this last crop has been particularly critical because Italy had 50% of production. Spain, I mean, the total world production is 3 million tons.
Mm, that's total.
Total.
Three million tons.
3 million tons of. Tons of olive oil, finished product. So Spain usually, when there's a good season, has 1.5 million. It's usually 50% of it.
They're huge. They produce half the world's olive oil.
This year was 1.2 million tons. So a significant loss in production. Italy produced 50% of the 500,000 that they usually produce. Tunisia had a low production. Greece had a low production. So there was a lack of production. California, that is still insignificant in the quantity,
right,
will represent 3% of the world production, had a very bad production. So it's been a very bad year. We increased that, for example, for the Italian olive oil, went to up to 100% of the cost of raw material increase. And Spain, like country like Spain, had a 30-40% increase in cost. And it's difficult, again, to explain to the consumer those swing from 1 year to the other, because next year can go back to 2 years ago. And so, but it's a market that is based on the nature. So if it rains, or if it rains too much, if it doesn't rain enough, it's. I mean, the good news is that the trees always survive. It's not like hazelnuts. They always survive. They don't need a lot of water to survive, but in order to produce, they do.
So 3 years ago, I remember I was in Italy in the fall, and there was two different parasites that were the problem. They'd had a real mild winter. They never had a hard freeze the winter before. And I'm talking about from Tuscany all the way down. But you don't get hard freezes in Sicily. But in the northern region, Tuscany, Umbria, they never had a hard winter. The spring was wet and foggy and not good. And they had some kind of a fly and a little like a mosquito. These two things almost never happened in the same year, and they both happened. And I know in parts of Tuscany, a lot of Tuscany, that year they had zero oil.
Yeah.
What was the cause this year of the problem?
This year was a combination of similar problems. Some area had the fly, the olive oil fly. There was too much water in some area, and the wrong. It depends even the water and the lack of water depends even on when.
Right.
You know, it can be
just like wine. If it rains during the harvest, you're dead.
2 years ago, there was a lot of talk about the low production, because at the same time there was the problem of an infection to the plants that would kill the trees. So there was a lot of that going on, but was, thank God, I mean, unfortunately, was we lost a lot of very old trees, so pretty trees. But for production, it's not significant, mm-hmm. because those trees don't produce anymore. Don't produce, no harvest, let's say, anymore. Unfortunately, that bacteria was found, it was solved, and so the problem is not present anymore. But there was a lot of talk, because people were worried about this spreading around in other countries and other areas of Italy.
Yeah, because the olive trees, I learned this, the olive trees are incredibly sturdy. I've traveled through southern France, through Spain extensively, through Italy extensively, and I use the wine analogy because we'll just pick Italy. I don't know what the total amount of grape varietals are in Italy, but it exceeds 2,000 grape varietals, including ancient indigenous ones, you know, we all know the Big Ten, but there's lots and lots of smaller ones. And with olive varieties, there's well over 1,000 throughout Italy.
The one in production, there are many, but the one in production are over 400, which is a big number. And while you compare, for example, with California has three varieties. So Spain has 10 varieties.
Italy has how many? Three.
Three. Mainly three. Then, they, you know, they can be added, but they make production, significant number of production are three varieties. In Spain, you have 10 varieties. Italy is the richest country of varieties, and that gives that balance, that flavor. I mean, the oil can...
And just like wine, it depends on the terrace, it depends on the altitude, it depends on the varietal, it depends... I mean, I think the analogy between olives and grapes are just... It's pretty much spot on. And olive trees are crazy. So most every other tree that I know, if you cut the tree at the ground level, you get a saw and you cut it and you leave a stump in the ground, that tree is dead. You do it to an olive tree and they grow back. Right?
You don't kill them.
You know, it's crazy. You don't kill them, right? They're like for some reason. I mean, they have this, and I also think, like, you know, olive oil goes back like to biblical times. It's so ancient in history that we've been using it for medicinal reasons, for cooking. It's like this great relationship between men. But the olive tree, like, I remember like going in olive orchards and seeing the tree cut down. And say, what's the matter? So it's going to grow back. And then I would see trees that they had cut down the same way years ago with a new shoot coming up the middle. So they're almost indestructible except for this mold you're talking about.
Yeah.
Sorry, let's bore down without getting too geeky. You have been the leader in Italian extra virgin olive oil for as long as I've known. And for most of that time, now you're branching out because you've grown so much as a brand that Italy's not producing enough oil for you. So I believe you're sourcing oils from other countries as well now?
We do different collection. We have still, and our primary focus is always the 100% Italian, which is our roots and where we come from and what the, you know, our brand design with. But at the same time, we offer different selection from the world. We have a European selection. We have 100% Spain, 100% Greek, 100% Portugal, 100% Australian. So we offer a selection of the world. And this could to give the consumer an opportunity to taste right. other oil profile right. and to have fresh oil all year long. Because, of course, Australia is producing oil at the opposite time.
Right, they're counter-seasonals. Yeah. Like right now, it's the middle of the summer in Australia. The harvest will be in the spring. That fresh oil hit the market in the summer, which is 6 months ahead of when your Italian oil will come in next year's harvest.
And I have to say that we were the first company to launch this concept after Fairway, actually, because Fairway with Steve Jenkins was the first idea of a collection of the world. But as a brand, we were the first one to launch, and then Whole Foods came and other companies joined this concept, which I think is important because it gives as in wine, you can want to try more countries, more varieties. Even on the oil, it's good to have this opportunity and open your mind. I mean, of course, my heart is Italian, so I would say, yes, Italian. But at the same time, it's good. Greece has a tremendous oil.
Yeah, there's wonderful oils. I've traveled to Morocco, and I mean, the Middle East has great oils too. They're just it just really depends on the fruit. And they're all a little bit different in terms of the flavor profile.
And then sometimes the problem is with Italy is quantity, but can even be quality. Like this year or 2 years ago, it's tough to find the right quality, and we want to maintain that high level of quality and premiumness for our consumer. So that's why we offer the collection. If there's not enough of Italian, you can buy the other selection. Right. But there's something high-quality product every country has.
I was in Peru a couple of years ago filming for the show, and they've got olive oil. I was like, I had no bloody idea. I mean, I knew they had avocados and seafood and, all kinds of grains and stuff, but they have olive oil. So the world's olive oil consumption keeps increasing, can I assume
yes,
that?
Yes, yes.
And America must be leading the way with that. American olive oil consumption must be going
up. If you consider that in the U.S., the average consumption is 1 liter per year. Per person.
But that's up from nothing.
Yeah.
That's
so in Italy, we have a family of four use a bottle a week.
Yeah, I think in my house, it's the oil we use all the time.
Depend.
Jerry talking about.
Depend which one. I use a bottle a day.
It's a lot of oil.
I love it. Why?
Yeah.
I put them everywhere.
So, Jerry, let's jump to you for 1 second. Talk about you. You have this crazy story. So you came here as a kid. You basically left here, told your mom you were going somewhere else in Italy, hopped on a boat, ended up in New York, did a bunch of things, from Brooklyn Navy Yard to construction. But I want to get you in Chelsea in the 70s. So at some point, you'd morphed from construction to this to that. You were doing flea markets.
Yes, I do.
And you were in a building on 17th Street.
No, I started on Chamber Street.
The old one that was used
the
to be
old
down
market.
There. Yes.
Then I started on 17th Street, where it was really the heart of the perfume people. It was all perfume we sold. But we don't want to sell perfume. We will sell like everything we can buy. You know, we used to sell a 2 liter bubble bed. After the bubble bed, you know, you get rash.
You also, I want to put it, what year was this? Late 70s?
It was 72.
Yeah, early 70s. So just, I mean, really, up until Zeckendorf built those towers on the southeast corner of Union Square Park, Union Square was a horrible neighborhood. I mean, really, Manhattan south of 42nd Street.
The Needle Park.
It was Needle Park. The park itself was a joke. 14th Street was, it was 99-cent stores. It was just, I never shopped there, and I had no money. It was like,
come on. You shop there. Everybody shop there.
No, I really didn't. But I was working 6 days a week. I didn't
everybody
shop
at Mace.
I was a cook.
You never went to Mace?
No, I never went.
Went to Client?
I wore whites. They gave me uniforms.
You were the man with the money.
No. I wasn't Spacone. I was a punk. But that neighborhood back then was crazy. So this is a crazy story. So you had this store, and then your partner who was with you decides he just wants to leave, and he gives you his half the business.
Right.
He buys an Eldorado Cadillac and drives across country.
Right, but an Eldorado from the garbage man and said, that's what I am.
And this is a beautiful Eldorado.
I'm going to go to Vegas.
This was the convertible. This car was about 22 feet long. It looked like a land yacht. When I was a kid, I was working in a restaurant in Philly. And the owner, one of the owners had a Rolls Royce, the other had a Cadillac Eldorado. And when it was slow, they'd make me they'd tell me to wash their cars, which I was happy to do. And I just love that Eldorado. The door on that Eldorado was like 6 feet long. It was such a cool American car.
And this one was a gold. gold.
But anyway, so your partner leaves, and then you're talking to your landlord, and you make a deal with your landlord that you're going to buy the building.
He came and offered it to me.
Okay.
I had no money.
You had enough money to give him a little deposit.
I had no money. How am I going to buy it?
How did you buy it?
How did I buy it? He came back. He said to me, he says, why don't you take it? I'm going to take it. Give me the money. He said, you know what? You give me a little bit of time. We name it the price. We shake hand.
That's it.
That's it.
No formal document. No
document.
A legal thing. Every 3 months, this is what you pay me. Here's the interest if you're late.
It was a paper.
Piece of paper. You and him. Signed. Done. Yeah,
1975, I wrote the paper.
1975. So the building's on 17th Street, steps off of 5th Avenue.
Right.
Between 5th and Broadway, north side of the block. Four stories, five stories?
Five stories.
Five stories. If you don't mind going public, what did you pay for the building?
What I pay?
Yeah.
A loaf of bread.
Give me your
$80,000.
$80,000. $80,000 for a building on 17th Street. It's crazy. And then you had another story. So you have that building, and then one day you're mad because the building next to you is like a mixed-use building, and there's people living upstairs.
Beautiful
but they're
building.
Not supposed to put the garbage out because it's not commercial, it's residential, and that means you got to pay somebody else to do the blah, 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 because there's two different ways to put the garbage in New York. So you start getting mad, and you put the garbage back in her hallway because you know it's her garbage.
Right. She comes over to me the building.
She comes over to you, and she says, you know, do me a favor. Why don't you buy my building for me?
Right.
How much?
And the building, it's goes from 17th to 18th Street.
It's the entire block through.
It's 7,000 square feet.
Huge.
The artists, they used to live there. They used to pay $700 a month for the floor. And I said, how much you want it? She said, give me $350,000.
What year was this?
76, 77.
For that much space.
Today, it's maybe $15 million a loft.
Yeah, it's crazy. New York's hysterical that way.
But if I had the Giovanni Colavita, maybe I had the money.
Nobody had any money back then. We all have stories.
We were investing at the time.
I had a friend that wanted to sell me when I was living in Cape May and I wanted to come back. She had a one-family brownstone in Harlem, but southern Harlem, like Edgecombe Avenue in the 120s. And we went and we looked. She'd renovated three of the five floors. It was one family. This is the true story. This is 1991, 92. She wanted $130,000 for the brownstone. And I decided no, and I ended up moving to New Jersey, to Maplewood, and I bought a house, and I didn't like the suburbs too much, and I missed the beach. I could have bought a freaking brownstone in Harlem. Right now, that brownstone's worth $4 million.
Yeah, the property was nothing.
Yeah.
Look at Tribeca.
I know.
Tribeca was a nothing.
You had a Tribeca story. What was that story?
I had a building in Tribeca.
The Bazzini Nut? What was the story about those buildings?
I bought a building right by Ponte, the restaurant.
By Filippo Ponti.
I gave it
right off the water.
$325,000.
For a building?
For a building. I don't know what it's worth today. Then I was by the building by Bazzini. There is the old hospital in New York City where the two buildings are bridged
together,
in the middle.
Yeah, across the street.
Right. And was $280,000.
For a building.
For the building.
A loft building. So that's one of these buildings.
But there was the...
The floors are 4 feet concrete thick. The walls are 6 feet thick.
But you walk in, you know, at the hole in the ground, a metal plate where they used to pull the pallet. That's what you buy.
Yeah.
But today, that loft, it's $40 million.
I know. It's crazy. New York's crazy that way. Let's take a quick break for the sponsors of the show to get their shout-outs. And we're going to come back, because, Johnny, I want to talk to you about... We had a guy here a while back who wrote a book. Was it called Truffle Boy or something? He was good. Young kid. Stoked kid. Got himself in the truffle business. He's from the middle of nowhere, from Omaha or Oklahoma or something. And now he's like one of the biggest truffle guys, really into fine ingredients. Young, young guys in his 20s. And we go out on the subject of olive oil, and I was talking about all of the fraud that's been in olive oil over the years because the American labeling laws are so ridiculously porous on things like country of origin, which we won't want to go into. But, I mean, you and I know that you guys have been playing by the rules since day one. But a couple of the other brands that might begin with a B and end with an I or an O and have Bertoldi or Burio in the middle, I mean, they were selling olive oil for years that looked like it was product of Italy, said product of Italy, and it was just tank farm stuff. Like, you had no idea what DNA was in all of it. It was a commercial blend of stuff they were buying on the world market.
I mean, the problem with the olive oil, I think the major problem is in the food service industry, where there is zero controls in this country, unfortunately, on the quality of olive oil, of the blends. And at retail, I mean, the major player are play a fair game in the quality of the product is legit. Mm. The origin is still a problem because the way the regulation, I mean, we decide to go straight and like our 100% Spain, say on the front in, you know, in huge capital letters, say 100% Spain, 100%, because we want to transfer to the consumer the message, as I was saying before, that the origin doesn't mean anything, doesn't mean quality or not quality. The quality is a characteristic in itself, not on the origin. Because every country has great product and terrible product. Yep. That's true for every country, yep, including our country.
Yep.
So, but the consumer using the Italian, using the imported from Italy, packed in Italy, separate from the countries of origin, is something that is not fair to the consumer. Because most of the company, they do that, they put on the front, big, imported from Italy or packed in Italy, and then in the back, you see Tunisia, Spain, Greece. That doesn't mean bad, but they do that packet in Italy in the front, yeah, because the consumer
it's like switching bait.
I mean, assume it's, right, it's Italian,
right?
And they use Italian name. They use
Tuscany, but it's olive oil. But yeah, people, they recognize the name.
Yeah, Jerry and I were talking. I remember
Tuscany.
I remember years ago I was at Whole Foods, I think, and I was looking for tomatoes, and there was a 28-ounce tin of tomatoes there. It was a white paper label, and it was a pretty fancy label. It was a 28-ounce white paper label, had a colored red tomato, and in black ink it said San Marzano. I thought, that's really interesting. So I bought the can, I took it home, I opened it up, and these were Jersey tomatoes or California tomatoes. And it's a company that's made, its whole business is they label their tomatoes, I mean, as if San Marzano was like a name that doesn't mean anything, and they're not even Italian tomatoes.
Well, that's what they're doing.
But on the other side, we have to be careful at the same time, because there has been a campaign, pushed by the California industry to denigrate everything is important in the olive oil business and try to say it's not legitimate, the other is not legitimate, the other is not legitimate. I mean, those have companies, including us, being in this business for 4 years. We were the first company in the extra virgin olive oil in this country. So let's be careful, because a lot of that, it's a campaign against the imported product. Mm. There is some truth, again, especially in food service, but most of it is product packed here, not imported. There's a lot of cheating in the food service industry with companies. They don't have a brand. They have nothing to lose. They get a fine. So what? They have cheated for so much volumes. They can recover. We have a brand as a company, as other important brand in this country. So I can afford to make a mistake on my quality, right, because I end up on the newspaper and then my consumer. So my quality is consistent in food service and in retail. People, they don't have a brand. They are just doing food service in a garage or it's not their problem. That's the major problem.
We'll talk about that after the break. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back in about 3 minutes with Jerry Tursi from Bizarro Tursi. The Bizarro comes from his former partner, who was bizarre enough to leave the business and drive across country to El Dorado. And Giovanni Profaci, because I want to talk more about, we'll talk about that, the institutional olive oil problems, and then like break down what extra virgin is, what the next type of oil is, things like pomace and how they extract pomace oil, and then how it all gets blended and confused. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable sourced olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavita's living in Rome, Colavita's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well.
I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years, and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife, Charlie, started Bob's Red Mill almost four decades ago. Today, they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his four children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast. Welcome back. All right, Giovanni, let's pick it up. So you're right about the food service thing, because I used to be in the restaurant business. And I knew about olive oil. So let's talk about how olive oil's made. Let's just start from the beginning. So we have these olive trees, and back in the old days, yeah, these you'd have farmers that would put ladders up in the trees and have a little rake, and they would rake the olives off. They had little ground would be covered by blankets, and the olives would fall onto the ground, and that was the old harvest. Now I believe a lot of the harvest is mechanical with those machines that shake the tree, right?
Yeah.
Same idea. But then there's at this point you kind of Not kind of. At this point, you kind of quickly want to do an inspection of the olives that you're harvesting, if there's any bad ones, to get rid of them. But you want to get it quickly to the press. The longer it waits, the more issues you have. Just like wine. When you pick the grapes, you want to get those grapes out of oxygen, crushed, get that juice down, and start the fermentation. Talk about how the olive oil harvest works now. And I know you're not using the old Woodlow's grinders, not Montoya, the old grinders, the old stone grinders, not those anymore. Because now you've got the ones that expand. But talk about how olive oil is made in Italy and what makes extra virgin in terms of testing and organoleptic examination.
Yeah, the harvest is still not fully mechanized in Italy because we don't have intensive growth like California or Argentina or other country have it, or Spain. But we have still a traditional system. So we have trees, big trees, and we have the most advanced, let's say, mechanization in the olive oil harvest are the shakers, but you still have the collection of the olives after you shake, and the process is the shaker make the process faster, and the goal is to keep, as you were saying, the olives from the moment get picked, start the oxidation process and the aging process on the olive. So you want to make that as quick as possible, to the mill in order to process those olives. And this is the other thing in Italy, different from other countries, is the fragmentation of the property. You don't have 100 acres, 200 acres. You have small property, that and the owner of the product at the end are the millers, because they buy the olives from the producer and they control the product. While in the largest country, like in the different system, like the California or the Spain, the producer control the product, or the large cooperative control the product, because they have their own mills, because they have larger properties. But anyway, once you process with the traditional system of the automatized one that used again in California, you still obtain it's the timing to the mill that makes the difference, and the quality of the olives, of course, first.
Right.
So once you harvest the olives and you process the olives with whatever process you use, traditional or the other process used, the most modern system used, you obtain an oil that has to be, after obtained, you have to analyze in order to know if it is extra virgin or not. And will depend from if you follow the process, if you have the right olives, the right timing and the right process. So what makes the extra virgin is the acidity level. But it's not enough anymore. Before it used to be, as long as it's below a certain grade of acidity, it's extra virgin. Now it has to have some positive characteristic in addition to it. So it has to be evaluated. There is a panel system.
Correct. There is. In Italy, there's people, in Italy, like sommeliers, there's men and women that are certified as olive oil tasters, and they do this on a daily basis, basically. Yes.
So the oil is subject to that, too. And so that's the top of the category, so the extra virgin olive oil. Then we go in other product like the olive oil, the pure olive oil is called in the United States, which is a combination of refined olive oil and virgin olive oil. So when the oil, it's called the fine lampante in Italy, so it's above a certain acidity level and has some defects in terms of odor, gets refined, and with the chemical adds, the oil basically become tasteless and smellless.
Yeah.
So in that
it's
point,
a hexane extraction. It's the same. It's in that gasoline, hexane, benzene. They use for somehow that you're able to take like that either the oil and also the leftover pits, that mess, and then still extract oil from that with hexane and a centrifuge. But it's not good oil.
Basically, gets those defects get taken away. The oil you get is still the same, but is without any of those characteristics. And then the reason why it's a request to add virgin olive oil to it is to give back flavor and some taste. So that's the olive oil that has a different usage. It's not better or worse. It's a different product. It's a different application, as you know, as a chef. It's, the extra virgin is as a usage. The olive oil, it's an oil that, because was treated with high temperature, the pure olive oil, it can be used because it's, as a higher point of smoke.
Yeah, people always used to, when I used to do radio and get phone calls and do cooking classes, people would ask if I sautéed with extra virgin olive oil, and I said, no, I really don't. A, it's too expensive. I don't have that kind of budget. But B, a lot of what I love about it, the esters, the delicate, that gets lost with heat. I mean, you put a pan on the stove, let that oil smoke before you put your protein in it. That oil's over 400 degrees, and at that point, you've ruined the extra virgin olive oil.
Yeah.
So you may as well be using pure olive oil or pomace oil or whatever.
Or the blends, the canola and the blends that is basically is a more an American thing. In Europe, we don't use blends.
Right.
But in the U.S., the largest product used for those kind of applications are the blends.
So what's the word you use? I'm calling it pomace. What's the word in Italy for that kind of oil?
Sansa.
Pomace,
basically, it's a similar process to the olive oil, to the refined olive oil, to the pure. And is the only difference that one is coming from the oil, the other is the pomace is extracted from the leftover after the crushed of the olives, whatever is left.
So it's that murky, muddy looking, but you can still get something out of it, and that's how they extract the pomace.
You extract that, and again, it's the same. The oil becomes tasteless and smellless and flavorless, and at that point, you have to add, again, virgin olive oil to add that
flavor character to get it. So you can add 10, 15, 20%, and you'll have some semblance of...
Yeah, each one has... There's not a minimal request, really, but there is there is a request to add, and so it goes from 10 to 15 to 20%. So it depends from the each company that this makes its own decision.
Olive oil storage. We know that olive oil, just like wine, again, if you have it in glass containers at home, it doesn't like sunlight, it doesn't like heat, and it doesn't like oxygen. Exactly like storing wine. So you want to keep a lid on it, you want to keep it in a cool space, and you want to keep it in a closet or something. What about refrigerating olive oil? Is that considered a no-no?
No, no, it's not a problem. The problem with the refrigerating olive oil that people, they do that, or when in the supermarket sometimes it's too cold.
It solidifies.
Solidifies. Yeah. And you start getting complaints and phone calls. The oil is not good. The oil is not. And unfortunately, even some chef don't know that, which is surprising still. But the problem is that that's a natural part of oil. If it doesn't happen, it's a problem. Because I know that fat of oil does solidify. If you don't have it, you have to worry about it. If you put it in the refrigerator and the oil doesn't solidify, it's a problem.
When you put extra virgin olive oil in your refrigerator, come back in a day, it should be a white, solid, almost looks like wax. So what happened to it? The answer is don't worry about it. It's good. When you go to use that next time, take it out, let it sit at room temperature for an hour or two. It'll come clear again and go ahead.
But the oil doesn't need to be refrigerated. Needs to be, you know, doesn't need to be in the heat, of course. But room temperature is fine for the oil, and the lights is the light and the air are the two major enemies
oxygen.
Of the oil.
It's exactly like wine.
So
that's why they use a lot of black bottle now.
Yeah, and I still think those 3 kilo tins and even the smaller tins you see in Europe all the time, it looks like paint thinner in America. But those, like, you know, I don't know what the size is, but in Europe, it's I would imagine the vast majority of retail olive oil is in some form of a tin.
Because they use more.
Yeah.
And actually, we see more and more, and we are following this new segment of the smaller sites, which is growing, because there are a lot of single, there are a lot of... And the new generation knows more and more about, they read, they get educated. Now the social media helps a lot of it. Even if they don't travel, they get to know. And they are aware of it, and they buy smaller sites. They buy a quarter liter, they buy half liter. They don't buy 1 liter if you are single, because it will last you, if you use a liter per year, it will last you 4 years. I mean, so it's the usage is growing, especially in the area where the youngest, like in the San Francisco area, where now in the all the young new generation are concentrating. You know, that's an area where the smaller sites are growing.
That makes sense. Even I know, even with me, with my family now it's just me and my wife and one of my sons home. When I used to make tomato sauce, I used to open up a 28-ounce can of tomatoes, and that was there would always be some leftover, but that was like my kind of go-to size. Now I love, you know, Cheerios got that small, I don't know what it's called, it's that little plastic pack.
A recut.
I love it. I mean, it's like 10 or 12 ounces. That's like the perfect size for tomato sauce for three people. So it's the same sort of thing. Like, why make extra and freeze it when you can make enough and it's just for dinner? Jerry, how's your business growing? It's growing like crazy.
Very good. Very good.
How many years have you been in Englewood?
Maybe 20.
And your customers, you've got a great loyal customer base. Because again, as I mentioned in the setup, you're not like on a main street where you can take the train and you're going to walk past the hair salon and the puppy store and the Duane Reade. No, you're kind of in an industrial area where you have to know, you're driving there specifically to go to Bizarro Turchi.
Or you drive it, or you walk. If you walk to go and buy a Porsche next door, you walk.
You got a Porsche dealer next door?
Next door. It's Dan Motor.
I didn't
Porsche,
know that.
Audi.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
That's the people that walk. But they actually look at the building. Sometimes they wait, they're coming in. And they don't get out.
28,000 square feet, which is almost half the size of a giant supermarket. Most supermarkets today, the big ones in the suburbs, try and opt for 40,000 square feet when they can. So you're big. You've got a full-on kitchen making food every day. You're making fresh mozzarella every day. You do wholesale or just retail?
I do a little bit wholesale.
But mostly retail?
I will sell the world.
And wine, too.
Wine. We do a big selection of wine.
That's a great selection, actually.
So what were you telling me last night? I don't remember the wine part at all.
We handle about 1,500 Italian wine, mostly Italian. Very little Argentina, maybe France, very, very little.
He has a sommelier that's recommend you
he's
the wine.
He's a winemaker. So, he's fantastic.
And it's another, you know, talking about Italy and quality. I mean, all of us, I'm... in the last month, I've had two master sommeliers on the show, Pascaline and Fred Dex, and another, Victoria, who's and her husband, who's Kermit Lynch's representative for the United States. So we talk about wine a lot on this show. And in Italy, it's true everywhere, but I think in Italy, too, because I'm Italian, I kind of take it personally, the quality's really radically improved in the last 20 years across the board.
Yep.
From Chianti to Sicily. I mean, I think about, like...
Especially the South.
You go back Sicily 20 years ago, and it was just Nero d'Avila. It was just... They didn't care. It was big and yield. They were selling it to the mainland to blend. And now I go to Sicily. I mean, Mount Etna is one of the most talked-about wine-growing regions on planet Earth. And down South, it's just getting cleaner and better and more refined, and it's really great to see. That
they're very good. The South start to really put out great wine.
No, Italian wines are super. So you got, tell me about the restaurant. We got to do this at the end. So Al Nicoletti, how did you guys meet up on this idea? Because I remember you told me years ago, I got a building, I got want to do something with it.
Restaurant before in Tenafly. And we used to cook a lot of authentic Italian food. But it was maybe the wrong year. People didn't understand.
Mm.
You know, they want the American stuff. And I lost track because they used to come in and they want to use Parmigiano and seafood. And he said to me, Jerry, this is America. Why not? I say, you know what? This is America. Get up. Go to Charlie Brown.
No, the story of the restaurant is funny. Jeff is a large as a wholesaler, is a large distributor of our product, especially on the chocolate side and the Baci Perugino.
I get no money, Mike. I'm going to shake my down like they shake down the olives.
And one day I walk in his office, and he say, "We're going to do a restaurant." I said, "Where? What?" Said, "We're going to open a restaurant." I say, "Yeah, you know those things." You say, "Yeah, we'll do it."
We meaning you and him.
Me, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll do it. And you know, I left. We'll go back and, oh, by the way, the restaurant. Yeah, we'll do the restaurant. One day he tell me, okay, so next month we have to start with... I said, "What do you mean we have to start?" Yeah, next month. The tenant is leaving. We are ready. So we call the architect, we do that. But the decision was, let's do something authentic Italian, affordable, casual, not something where everyone can come and can enjoy Italian food with no compromise, as Jerry was saying. Not putting Parmigiano where it doesn't need to be put,
right,
and using all authentic ingredients. So between the product we import, the product Jerry wholesales, we had all those authentics. And plus we use other, of course, special... supplier, like, you know, the fantastic fish from Citadella, and all the supplier authentic good food, Italian, and I mean, fish is not Italian, it's not going to be Italian, but fresh ingredients. And we had that, where we said, how we put this together, we found a young Italian chef from Puglia, and which doesn't like compromise, so we said, okay, well, that's what we wanted. And we put together, I mean, it's not my business, definitely, but it's it's a pleasure, and it's enjoying bringing friends over and seeing that they come back and say, oh, finally we find... Because in New York, there are many restaurants, but there is not many authentic, non-compromise, casual restaurants.
Yeah.
It's true. And to be into wholesale and hear about all these restaurants, when they want to buy pasta, it's got to be... you can count them on a hand that they use good pasta.
Which is crazy, right?
You're
saving pasta is nothing.
I was about to say, even at home, like if you don't buy good, like what's pasta, a pound of good pasta costs $4, $3, $4, $5, whatever. What's Parmesan Reggiano cheese cost? The cheese is more expensive than the pasta. Sometimes the tomatoes are more expensive than the pasta. I mean, why would you cheap pasta is so bad. It's like you ruin a dish.
The pasta, you do four portions.
In a pound.
It's a dollar.
Yeah, I know, it's nuts.
The Parmigiano, if you put a spoon, it's a dollar and a quarter.
I agree. I know.
You know what I mean? But people, they don't understand.
I know Americans are funny when it comes to that. I don't get it.
And that's the biggest problem that the peoples expect what they expect from Italy. Because today, everybody travels. They're coming back, and they see there is a different, okay? And me, personally, when I go, sometime I left. The guy says, tonight we have a special. Pappardelle with tartufo. Yeah? How much? $70. What do? You give me a tartufo? I mean, like, that's crazy to me.
Yeah, well, that's it's the restaurant business, and that's the truffle business.
I understand that the rent, I understand everything. But I don't know, I think became a rage, and a lot of the things, like I say, I can't say aloud, but a lot of restaurants, they want to buy cheap ingredients.
Yeah, I can't disagree. I mean, you know this with the olive oil business. We see it in the side. I mean, when I had my restaurant in Cape May, New Jersey, you know, Cape May's not a rich town, and we had to keep the prices reasonable. And I had to find good wholesalers, and I was buying from Al Cicatelli, the Don Cento, at the time. Al was a good friend of mine. So, and he is in South Jersey, so I was getting my tomatoes from him and my pasta from him, and I was buying DiCecco. It's a really good Abruzzese pasta. I grew up eating it. And Al was like, why don't you – I have my own brand, Anna. A-N-N-A. Why don't you use Anna pasta? And I said, dude, I've cooked with it before. It's not the same. Like, but I can give you a deal. I said, but to your point, I don't care if Anna's half the price of DiCecco. That doesn't matter to me. There's four portions in a pound. We're talking about nickels and dimes. And, one is al dente and delicious, and the other one, not so much. So it's funny.
What I recommend to my customer, even the scheme by San Marzano. Nobody, American, they know the San Marzano, it's 1 square mile.
It's tiny. I was there. I visited.
The rest, the land, it's Pagano, Nocera, Vietri, Pestum. It's go up to it. And then the trail they come down from north, from Rome, and they go down to Hungary. And they make a tomato. Then they put it on the thing, San Marzano. You know, it's a lot of things. You know, we are in the air. But it's a lot of company. That's what they do.
Yeah, I know. The food business is crazy. And the U.S., it doesn't help that... I mean, Europe's a lot better with the labeling laws, but in the U.S., the labeling laws are just a joke. I mean, we have no inspectors. There's no credibility to it. You can kind of call anything and get away with it, and you're not going to get called out. It's just the
way
it is.
But inspection is a quality. No, as a region. It means like, you know, San Marzano is San Marzano. And whatever you jar, you put a San Marzano. But you don't take the semi, the season, from San Marzano. You bring them to Pestum, and you call them a San Marzano tomato.
Well, you got to tell the Italians that, too, because the Italians are famous for this. You know, this idea didn't start in America.
But the Italians,
right?
They got a hard head. They don't want to listen.
I know, it's funny. I deal with it. Guys, thanks so much for coming out. Giovanni Caldavita, thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
And thank you again from my heart for your family, because since day one, I believe since the very first episode of my show on PBS, you guys have been on board. You've helped this station the last 2 years. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Keep up the great work. Welcome, because now you're raising your family on the Upper East Side, so you're a full-time resident. Welcome to New York City. Jerry Tercey.
Thank you, Mike.
Not bad for a guy that...
Thank you.
What was your... Oh, right, so I was kidding a little bit. You graduated...
From the Harvard University, Naples.
Harvard University of Naples. That's exactly right. Go Google it. Stay tuned. We'll be back next week. I don't know what we're doing, but I've got a couple of guests. Take care. See you then.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Get real, real.
listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.